About the holiness of God. I'm reminded of Isaiah's vision of the Lord in Isaiah 6, where he saw a vision of the Lord and of the angels singing of his holiness. And Isaiah's response was, "Woe is me, for I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips." And when we consider the holiness of God, if we're honest with ourselves, it reveals our unholiness. And the fact that unless something changes there, we are face to face with a holy God whom we have sinned and rebelled against. And yet the amazing thing is Christians are consistently addressed as saints, as holy ones. And how can that be? It's because of what we've been singing about. It's because of Jesus Christ and the gift of His righteousness. Not the righteousness of man's efforts, which is imperfect and in God's eyes is like filthy rags, but that which is given as a gift by faith through Christ, His perfect righteousness given to us so that we might share in our God's holiness and we can be called holy ones. I'm sure you noticed in your bulletin that this morning we're going to be looking at Matthew chapter 25. So if you would please turn there with me in your Bibles. Matthew 25:14 is where we'll be picking up. And the message is entitled for this morning, "A Sobering Call to Faithfulness." A sobering call to faithfulness. And we'll be looking at one of Jesus's familiar parables. It's probably titled in your Bible, "The Parable of the Talents." And I wanted to just give a little bit of context for us this morning as we get started to understand, you know, why is Jesus communicating this parable? What's the point? What is he trying to get across here? Well, this parable is part of a larger section of Jesus' teaching, which has become known as the Olivet Discourse, which probably some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with. And it begins back in chapter 24. If you just turn over a page there, you'll see that Jesus had just made an amazing statement to the disciples. In the previous chapter, starting in verse 23:13, Jesus spent a good deal of time giving some very severe rebukes to the Pharisees, the scribes, the hypocrites, the religious rulers of his day who had rejected him. And he really just blows them away with one rebuke after another, after another, after another. And in verse 37 of chapter 23, Jesus, he laments over Jerusalem and the judgment that would be coming on Jerusalem. It's important to point out that at this point, this is actually Tuesday of what has become known as Passion Week. This is the final week of Jesus' life when he communicates this teaching. So Jesus knows that his time is very short. He knows that his crucifixion is quickly approaching. And so it adds even more weight to what Jesus is communicating here. And he says in chapter 23, verse 37, "Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. For I say to you, from now on you will not see me until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And Jesus came out from the temple, chapter 24, verse 1, and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. The temple, as many of you know, was a magnificent building, and it was actually still under construction at this point. And historians have noted the unusually large stones that were used in this massive structure. And one historian, Josephus, pointed out that some of the stones were up to 37 foot long by 12 foot high by 18 foot wide. That's a big stone. And so you can imagine, you know, it's kind of like if you go downtown or if you've ever been to New York City or something like that and you look and see some of those skyscrapers and structures, it's pretty amazing just to look at. So, you know, their disciples are just kind of like, whoa, Jesus, look how amazing this temple is here. And these words are familiar to us, but we have to try to put ourselves in the disciples' sandals and think about how they would have heard these words of Jesus. And he said to them, do you not see all these things? Verse 2. Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another which will not be torn down. I'm sure that was a very shocking statement for them to hear. And there's no doubt all kinds of questions that must have been swirling around in their mind. And so later on that day, we were told in verse 3, as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives. Now, real quick, just a quick little geography lesson here. If you're heading east out of Jerusalem, I should have a picture to show this and make it easier. There's a range of mountains that are going north to south. And on that range of mountains, there's a hill which is known here, which is addressed here as the Mount of Olives. And so that would have actually been overlooking the Temple Mount. So you get the picture, they're kind of sitting here on the Temple Mount, the Mount of Olives. Sorry, not on the Temple Mount. They're on the Mount of Olives, and they're looking down over the Temple Mount. And no doubt the disciples, you know, are hearing these words over and over in their mind. This is not some crazy person that has told him this. This was Jesus. They know that these are true words that he has spoken to them. And so they come to him privately and they say, tell us, when will these things happen? When is the temple going to be destroyed? And they don't stop there. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Jesus, tell us when are these things going to happen? What are the signs that we should be looking for? And so what follows in verse 4, and Jesus answered and said to them, and then he goes on teaching them, warning them, instructing them. These are the things that are going to happen. This is what you need to be looking for. And although some of these prophecies were fulfilled, specifically regarding to the temple in 70 AD, when Jerusalem was invaded and the temple was destroyed and the actual stones were thrown down from the temple, as Jesus had prophesied here, much of what is recorded in here is not fulfilled until the end of the age, at the return of Christ, which was in keeping with their other questions. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? But not only did Jesus answer those questions, he went on to instruct them further, for Jesus knew that it would be a long time. It's been about 2,000 years now. It would be a long time until he returned, and so he needed to instruct his disciples and warn others how they were to be waiting, what they were to be doing in this interim time while they await the return of Christ. So So one of the dominant themes that runs through this teaching of Jesus, which is all of chapter 24 and all of chapter 25, is there's a call for people to be alert and to be ready for His return. This repeated theme, He warns them that His coming will be sudden and unexpected. But He does give them a number of signs that would indicate that His return was very close. And with it, the end of the age, which is also known as the consummation, the completion of all things. Daniel chapter 9, the vision given to Daniel there talks about the period of time, what was laid out for the nation of Israel, and what's referred to as the 70th week, this final seven-year period in God's dealings with His chosen people, with the nation Israel. And that's a lot of what we've been studying here in Revelation on Sunday mornings. And so we live in that period between the 69th and the 70th week. And we don't know when Christ will return. We know that His return is imminent. But it seems that the primary thing that Jesus is concerned for us is that we know how to live, what He's called us to, how we are to be waiting for Him. What does it mean to be ready for Jesus' return? That's what these parables answer for us. Do you want to know what it means to be ready for Jesus' return? Jesus has told us here. He told us what it looks like to be ready. And that's the theme of our study for this morning. Jesus often used parables and various illustrations, word pictures, to teach. He was a master teacher, and he knew how to communicate truth in a clear and effective way, in a way that people could understand. And one of the techniques that he uses was parables. Of course, the Gospels are filled with parables. And this parable, the parable of the talents, falls immediately on the heels of the parable of the 10 virgins, which was another parable related to how we are to be waiting and to be ready for Jesus' return. And there were the 5 wise virgins that were prepared and the 5 foolish that were not prepared. Let's read through the parable together in its entirety, and then we'll come back and walk through it together. So we're going to pick it up in Matthew 25:14. For it is just like a man about to go on a journey, who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. Immediately, the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them, and gained 5 more talents. In the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. But he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The one who had received the 5 talents came up and brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one who had received the 2 talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted 2 talents to me. See, I have gained 2 more talents. His master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You are faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. And the one also had received the 1 talent came up and said, Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow, and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, You wicked, lazy slave. You knew that I reap where I did not sow, and gather where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Throw out the worthless slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And so there you have the parable that's before us. Just wanted to give you a brief, simple outline here, just that we'll walk through the parable together. So in verses 14 to 15, we have the distribution of the talents. In verses 16 to 18, we have the investment of the talents. And in verses 19 to 30, we have the day of reckoning. So the distribution of the talents, the investment of the talents, and then the day of reckoning. And just at the start out here, I just want to point out that I believe the main idea that what the Lord is trying to get across to us here is that as servants of Christ, we are called to faithfully invest and labor with everything that He has entrusted to us as we eagerly await His return. We are called to faithfully invest and labor with everything, all that He has entrusted to us. So let's look here first at the distribution of the talents. Notice in verse 14, Jesus says, "For it is just like a man about to go on a journey." Okay, so we should stop there for a second and say, what is just like a man about to go on a journey? What are you talking about, Jesus? Well, if you look back at chapter 25, verse 1, just earlier, just a couple verses back, at the beginning of the parable of the 10 virgins, Jesus said, "Then the kingdom of heaven will be comparable to 10 virgins. So the same idea here in verse 14, we can insert, "For the kingdom of heaven is just like a man about to go on a journey." See the connection there. So this is what this parable is about. Just like the previous parable, it's about the kingdom of heaven. And specifically, it's about people being ready and prepared for the second coming of Christ, for Christ's return. We are introduced here to this man who is about to go on a journey. We learn that this man is none other than the Lord Jesus Christ. That is who this man represents. The parable is teaching here. The man is Jesus, and he is going on a long journey. He is, just like Jesus ascended, right, and promised his second coming, he will return one day. It's comparable to, it's parallel to, if you look back at the parable of the 10 virgins, it says in verse 5, "Now while the bridegroom was delaying, they all got drowsy and began to sleep." So the bridegroom of the previous parable is the same as the man going on a journey here, talking about the same one. And in the next, some refer to it as a parable, some just say it's a prophecy of what will happen. In verse 31, "The Son of Man comes in His glory." So this is the return. We'll get there in a minute. I'm getting ahead of myself. But when the man comes back, when he returns from his journey, that will be, that is speaking of Jesus' second coming, of his return. So, what we learn here later on in this parable is that this is not a short little trip to the supermarket that this man is making, but it is a long journey that he's taking. Because we're told in verse 19 that now after a long time, the master of those slaves came. And so before he goes away, this is the man of great wealth, and he wants to make good investments with what he has, right? So he is going to entrust these to these various servants of his that were to take his wealth, his possessions, and were to invest them and earn interest, earn profit for their master. That was the implied responsibility. So we're told here that he called his own slaves, verse 14, for it is just like a man about to go on a journey who called his own slaves and entrusted his possessions to them. So pretty simple. Again, he's got possessions. He's got a lot of them. He has these servants, these slaves, and he's going to give them, divvy up his possessions. But we're told here an interesting detail in verse 15. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his own ability, and he went on his journey. So this master knew his servants. He knew their capabilities. And so, you know, this one servant, apparently, the guy that got the 5 talents was very gifted, very capable, and so he gets the largest amount of the possession. The other man was probably more average in his ability and gives him 2. And the other guy apparently was, you know, not the sharpest on the block there. And so he gets the 1 talent. This was not blind or random apportioning. It was according to the master's knowledge of these servants and their abilities. And just as a side note here to consider, it's important for us to realize that each of us have been given different abilities from God, by God. God has sovereignly given us certain giftings. Just some of us might be gifted in music or athletics, working with wood, metal, computers, working with people. But I'm sure in whatever field or whatever area of interest you have, whether it be your work or your hobbies, you realize that there's people that are better than you, right, at what you do. It's just a reality. And as it's been said, all men are not created equal in the sense that we're not all given. We all have the same value and worth before God, but we don't all have the same abilities, right? That's why there's professional musicians and there's professional athletes and professional, and then there's the rest of us, right? Because we don't have those giftings and abilities that others, and we have to be okay with that. You know, for me, it was a humbling experience throughout life, even though I enjoyed basketball, to realize that I was never going to, make it to the professional, to the NBA. And in seminary, coming across a lot of guys that were just way smarter than me and could just do a lot more than I could read faster, could write better papers, were just more intelligent. And you know what? We have to learn to be okay with that. Because God has sovereignly given us the abilities that He's given us. And He gives us talent. He gives us, entrusts us things according to our ability. He knows, if He would have given 5 talents to the guy that was a 1-talent guy, that would have been unfair to him, right? And yet at the same time, if He only gave 1 talent to the 5-talent guy, he probably would have gotten bored with that. Because it would have been too easy for him. So there's an aspect that we need to trust God. And we need to be content. And the main idea in this passage is that we need to be faithful with whatever God has given us. Whether it be little or it be much, God calls us to faithfulness. And that's what we're going to see at the end of this parable here. So he gives them these talents, okay? So what exactly is a talent? In my Bible, there's a note that says that a talent was worth about 15 years' wages of a laborer. Now, of course, that was back in 1995 when this translation was completed and edited. So as you can imagine, things have changed a bit since then with inflation and all that. So the point is, it's difficult to know exactly what amount of money we're dealing with here. Obviously, if you're talking about 15 years' wages, that's a lot of money, right? And the difficulty is we don't know exactly what kind of metal are we talking about. A talent wasn't a sum of money based on weight. Sometimes that word is also used in the Bible just to speak of a weight. For instance, in the book of Revelation, we hear about these giant hailstones, right, that are coming down, and they're weighed out by the talent. So between 75 to 100 pounds is what these giant hailstones are going to be. And so just referencing that, that word talent can be used as strictly a weight, but in here it's being used as a reference to a weight of money. But obviously, if you have 5 pounds of gold, I'll trade you 5 pounds of silver for that if you want. You know, it's same weight. But it's not the same amount of money, right? There's a big difference. So we don't know exactly how much money, but we're probably talking potentially in the range here of hundreds of thousands of dollars. A lot of money was entrusted. This was not a small amount that the master was entrusting to their hands. Whether it was one talent or two or five, he had given much to them. So that completes the distribution of the talents. And then we go on to the investment of the talents in verse 16. We're told in verse 16, note that first word, immediately. Immediately, the one who had received the 5 talents went and traded with them. He didn't waste any time. He was eager to go to work right away. This man's devotion to his master is demonstrated by his swift and eager action to make good use of what had been entrusted to him. We're not told exactly how he went about and invested his money and made the money, but we're told that he did very well. He gained 5 more talents. That's 100% return on his investment. And I'm sure for those of you that know what it's like to try to invest and to try to, you know, earn more from what you have, being good steward of it, to make a return like that generally involves a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of diligence is implied that, you know, he didn't go out and play the lottery here. He went to work with what had been entrusted to him. He was faithful. He was diligent with his master's money. And then we're told in verse 17, in the same manner, the one who had received the 2 talents gained 2 more. So it appears that this man went about the same way. Immediately, he went out, took his master's money, started investing, started trading, started, you know, buying land or doing whatever he did to make sure that he was going to improve his master's wealth as best as he possibly could. So we can see here that there's a loyalty, there's a faithfulness, there's a diligence about the way that these men are going about their task. And they probably knew that the master was going to be gone for a long time. We don't know exactly, but nonetheless, they went out and got after it. We'll come back more to that later. Notice in verse 18, but he who received the 1 talent went away and dug a hole in the ground and hid his master's money. So you see there's a contrast here. See, the first man with the 5 talents, he goes out and he starts working right away. The other guy with the 2 talents, he's working. They're you know, expending themselves in service. Remember, they are servants. They are slaves of their master. It's not like he gave him the money and told him to go on a cruise down to the Caribbean. He said, no, you take the money, and, you know, that was the implication. You take it, you're my servant, you're my slave, I'm entrusting you with a lot of money, and I expect you to faithfully invest it, to bring back profit from it. He did not go out immediately and begin working with to invest his master's money. He had a different strategy, a different outlook. We don't know yet what is motivating this man's actions, but we're going to soon find out. The difference was the way that this man viewed his master. The difference was his relationship to his master. He was not a true servant, because when his master was away, you know, the mice will play, right? He was not, and he was also protecting himself, we're going to find out. There was a deficiency in his relationship to the master, and it was demonstrated by the way that he treated his master's possessions that had been entrusted to him. So we're told here that he goes, and instead of going out and trading with the talent, he digs a hole in the ground and he hides his master's money. Now, at the first glance, that might not seem like such a bad thing to do. Well, he didn't go out and, you know, waste it. He didn't try to steal it. We don't discover what the problem was with this man until the master returns and evaluates this man's work or his lack thereof. But before we go any further, let's think about something. Let's just say that each of these talents is worth $100,000. Okay? How much work would it take to successfully invest $200,000, based on the man with the two talents, to the extent that you were able to earn an additional $200,000 in profit? Would that take, shall we say, quite a bit of effort and work? What about doing that with $500,000? Taking $500,000, working it, investing it, overseeing it, being diligent with it, realizing that ultimately this didn't belong to them, did it? It was not theirs. It was their master's. And they were called upon to be faithful with what he had entrusted to them. Now let's compare the amount of work that the man with the $200,000 did and the man with the $500,000. And then let's think about how much work does it take to bury a suitcase with $100,000 of cash in it, in the ground. How much work? Well, depending on how hard the ground is, I guess, right? How sharp the shovel is. How in shape the digger is. There's some variable factors, but let's say, let's be generous. 3 hours, right? 4 hours. Maybe he takes a whole day because he wants to find a good spot, right? No one is looking. One day versus maybe years and years of faithful, diligent labor on the parts of these. Because you know what? Those men knew that there was a day of reckoning coming. They knew there was a day of accounting when they would look their master in the eyes and he would ask them, what did they do with what he had given them? And so they were working toward that day. And we're going to find out that they loved their master. They honored their master. They knew that their master was a good man. But this other slave, this other servant, he had a different idea. He had a different approach. In verse 19, now after a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. Do you see the parallel there to the return of Christ? In the previous parable of the 10 virgins, we're told in 25:6, but at midnight there was a shout, behold, the bridegroom, come out to meet him. There's a moment, there's a time, comes unexpectedly. Back in 24:48, Jesus gave a little short parable. And he said, but if the evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time. See the parallel here? Jesus is talking about his return, his second coming, and how his servants are to be ready, to be alert, to be watchful. What are they to be doing in this interim time? And it's also parallel again to verse 31, where Jesus says, but when the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit on His glorious throne. So we're all, do you see how all these parables are talking about the same thing? They're talking about the return of Christ and what's going to happen, the day of reckoning. Acts chapter 17, Paul said this to the people there in Athens. He says that the Lord God has fixed the day in which He will judge the world through a man, having furnished proof to all men by raising Him from the dead. Jesus Christ, there's a day fixed when He is going to judge. There's a day of reckoning coming. And so this is, as the title of our message indicates, it is a sobering call to faithfulness. As we're going to find out, the stakes are very high on this day of reckoning. So now after a long time, this master returns and he settles accounts with them. What did you do with what I entrusted to you? And the one who had received the 5 talents came up, verse 20, and he brought 5 more talents, saying, Master, you entrusted 5 talents to me. See, I have gained 5 more talents. You see, there's an excitement that might be somewhat lost in the English translation here, but it says, as if this servant is bubbling over with joy and excitement about the success of his business endeavors for his master, right? Like, it's like when you've done a good job and, you know, you want to, whoever's in charge over you, you want to tell him, hey, look, I did this. And so the master's been gone a long time. This man has been faithfully working and serving his master. And there's an excitement and then the joy. Master, it's like he's got two bags of money. You know, these five you entrusted to me. Look, I have five more. And the master shows equal excitement here. He says in verse 21, his master said to him, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Notice here the master calls him good and faithful. Not only was his actions good and faithful, but that's who this servant was. He was a good man and he was a faithful man. And his character was demonstrated by his works. It's very important that we are careful here not to communicate in any way that salvation is earned by our works. As it's been said, salvation is by faith alone, but saving faith is never alone. Saving faith produces actions. And just like in these servants, those that are truly Christ, when he returns, they will have demonstrated the fact that they are truly servants of his by their faithful service to him. It's not that they're trying to earn anything. It's that they love their master. And they've been given, entrusted with great things by their master, and they want to please him. Notice here the master says something else. He says, well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful with a few things. Notice that. That communicates us to us the wealth of this master, right? We're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars here. And this master says, yeah, that was a few things. You were faithful with those. But now, I will put you in charge of many things. Communicating to us the wealth of this master. And notice that the reward for this man's faithfulness is more opportunity to serve his master. And that does communicate something to us about eternity. And that we won't just be floating around on clouds, plucking harps, and kind of being bored and looking for something to do. The reward for his faithfulness is more opportunity, more entrusted to him. And we see here the generosity of this master, right? I'll put you in charge of many things. This is just the beginning. I have so much more that I want to give to you. Enter into the joy of your master. Do you see? This is not a harsh, cold taskmaster. He doesn't look upon this slave like property. He says, no, come, I want you to experience joy with me. I want to share my joy with you. And it's obvious that this servant had a love and a devotion to his master. He was excited about serving him. And the prospect of being able to serve his master more gives him more joy. And the encouraging thing is, we won't look at it in detail because it's basically a repeat of what we just looked at, but verses 22 and 23 are basically an exact repeat for the man with the two talents. Do you see why? Because the word comes up here in verse 21, good and faithful slave of the man with the five talents, you were faithful with a few things. Verse 23, the master's response to the man who had gained two more talents, good and faithful slave, you are faithful with a few things. You see a repeated word here? It was faithfulness. The man with the two talents couldn't handle five talents. That was beyond his ability. But the master says, well done, good and faithful servant. You were faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. See, he doesn't get slighted because he was a two-talent man. He was faithful with what God gave him. And mark this, brothers and sisters, if the man with the one talent would have done the same, he would have heard the same reply. But sadly, it would be nice if we could end the story here. But we can't, because Jesus doesn't end the story here. There's a contrast here, verse 24. And the one who had received the one talent came up and said, Master, okay, so far so good. That's what the other two had said, but sadly that's where the similarities end. Notice what he says. He begins with an accusation. I knew you to be a hard man. This servant did not think fondly of his master. He considered him to be cruel and unreasonable. One commentator remarked, it's kind of like the Pharaoh. Remember when Moses came and said, you know, the Lord has heard about you. He wants to relieve you of your suffering. And Pharaoh heard about it. And he said to the Israelites who were his slaves, he said, you know what? You guys are lazy. I'm not going to give you any more straw. You need to go out and find your own straw, but you still have to make the same amount of bricks every day. Talk about being harsh and unfair, right? That's how this man viewed this master. That's how this servant views Christ. He's harsh. He's unreasonable. He's cruel. Notice he goes on to say, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. You expect things from me you didn't even give me. You're a hard man. You're a harsh man. But we need to ask ourselves, is this slave speaking truthfully of this master? Was that the experience of the other two that had been faithful with what they'd been entrusted? Enter into the joy of your master. I'm going to put you in charge of many things. Does that sound like a hard man? Does that sound like a cruel master? We should take note that this description is also being used by this servant as an excuse, right? Because the other two have showed and they've come up with a lot, and now this man, all he's got is the same talent in his hand that he had maybe 10, 15 years, who knows how long it's been. He doesn't have anything extra to show for it. Let me draw a few conclusions here about this third servant's relationship with the master. He did not know his master. This man did not trust his master. He did not obey his master. And he did not love his master. His deeds were in keeping with his lack of faith and his lack of love. What we're dealing with here is somebody who is connected to the church, but in reality has no relationship with Jesus Christ. And he says, and I was afraid and went away and hid your talent in the ground. See, you have what is yours. But his master answered and said to him, you wicked, lazy slave. You knew that I reap where I did not sow and gathered where I scattered no seed. Then you ought to have put my money in the bank, and on my arrival I would have received my money back with interest. Therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. The master didn't buy into his excuse for a minute, did he? In fact, he points out the inconsistency. If you knew me to be that kind of man, at the very least, you would have taken my money to the bank and earned me a little bit of interest if I'm such a hard and cruel and demanding person. But he was just trying to cover up his own laziness, his own wickedness. He was looking for an excuse, and his excuse, he turns it around and points and blames. That's what people do today, don't they? They blame God. They blame Christ. They accuse him. Proverbs talks about a man who ruins his way and his heart rages against the Lord. He's angry at God, even though he's destroying his own way. He was afraid. He was afraid for himself. He was afraid to risk anything for his master. He didn't want to take any chances. But notice, he says, therefore, take away the talent from him and give it to the one who has the 10 talents. You know that verse that we read this morning at the start of the service? If anyone wishes to come after me, Jesus said, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. This man is an illustration of that principle, right? He sought to save his own neck. sought to protect himself, and in the end, he ended up losing everything. Take that talent away from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more shall be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who does not have, even what he does have shall be taken away. Now, I'll admit this is a difficult concept, and I wish I had more time to unpack it. But the reality is that what God entrusts to us, the gifts, the knowledge, if we are faithful with it, God will bless and add to it. And if we are unfaithful with it, it will diminish. It will fade away. We'll lose it. The little bit of light that's given to someone, if they reject it, they're not going to continually be given more and more and more light. In Matthew 13, we don't have time to look there, but you might just want to jot that down. Jesus talked about this principle more in Matthew 13:12, where he talks about this idea of whoever has more will be given, and he who doesn't have will be taken away. I want to close with pointing out this sobering fact that Jesus said, "Throw out the worthless slave," verse 30, "into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." This man was not a true slave. He was not a true servant. He was a fake and he was a phony. And his actions in his master's absence prove that he was not truly a servant of the master. He did not love his master, and his description of his master shows that he did not know the master. His lack of obedience shows that he did not love the master. Remember, Jesus said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." This man did not do that. He didn't love his master. He loved himself. He did things the way he wanted to do. This description of outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth, is a common description and designation for hell. This final servant was not a true servant of his master. He represents those who claim to be followers of Christ and are not. This worthless slave is equivalent to the 5 foolish virgins who were unprepared for the arrival of the bridegroom. He is like the evil slave in chapter 24 who takes advantage of his master's absence. He is like the goats and the accursed ones later on this chapter who are told to depart from the master. And the list could go on and on with the wheat and tares, those who had the wedding garments and those who did not. Jesus is concerned that people know that just because they are, he's concerned that just because people are part of a group, he doesn't want them to think that they're by that saved, that they're okay because they're Jews or because they're Christians or because you're a member of this church. The message is sobering that Jesus is returning and he will call us to account for what he has entrusted to us. And the greatest gift that he has given us is the gospel. And this man rejected that. He was unfaithful with that. He turned on his master, disobeyed him, demonstrated that he did not belong to him. Jesus said in Matthew 11:25, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was pleasing in your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. Come to me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Does that sound like a harsh taskmaster to you? So the challenge to you this morning, if you are not a believer, is that you would carefully consider your relationship with the Lord. Are you truly one of his servants? Or does your unfaithfulness to the master betray the fact that you are not truly one of his? That you view him as a harsh and a hard and a cruel person? And if you are a believer, we've all been entrusted with things. The greatest is the gospel. And yet he's given us spiritual gifts. He's given us resources. He's given us opportunities. He's given us knowledge. He's given us his word. And one day we will give an account, even as believers, for have we been faithful with what God has entrusted to us? Well, what we're going to do right now is I'm going to ask the men to go and prepare the communion for us. We have the privilege and opportunity this morning of remembering what our Lord has done for us, as we sang about this morning, that he died in our place, taking the punishment that we so rightly deserve. The question is asked, why do we gain from his reward? I cannot give an answer, right? But this I know with all my heart, his wounds have paid my ransom. God struck his son, and we are saved. That's amazing truth. I just want to invite you to take a minute just to prepare your hearts. And then the men will be passing the bread here in a moment. If the musicians can come forward.